This week on Pirate Party Radio, another Spanish court rules in favor of file sharing and compares it to a library. FTC considers taxing new thriving media to support old dying media. An RIAA court case against LimeWire could add up to $15 trillion. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 32 for Thursday, June 10th. 2010.
The digital lock is a key issue because the digital lock erases the natural copyrights freedoms that a citizen enjoys. For example, if you have a digital lock on a computer game so that somebody can't go and copy 500 copies and sell them for a buck each in the schoolyard, that's perfectly legitimate. That is WIPO consistent. That is what our international trading partners want. But to say, well, you could back up your songs onto a CD, but if the record company decides they don't want you to, well, then you're the same kind of criminal as a bootlegger if you back up your product.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, to control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last cohorts. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. And the intro clip that you heard was Charlie Angus denouncing the DRM in Bill C-32, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in the first story. But first, we've got some incoming messages. It's from Weird Wolf. There was a Tech Dirt article on how people basically did not care how businesses misused their data or screwed up losing it. Meaning that people, or not too many people, are not outraged enough for a business or corporation to really lose big. This article is from Advertising Age, which was linked in the Tech Dirt article and does a pretty good job of getting the basic thoughts down. From my travels all over the internet, I do believe this is what I'm seeing, and people say are a tad bit, but business basically does not lose much. Case in point, Facebook and how very little people had left after that threat of a lot of people leaving over the series of times over and over again that Facebook was lowering its privacy standards, and I've put a link in the forums. And really, I see this as well, as people not really caring a lot enough to go out of their way to do something about it on the internet. It's kind of disconcerting, but maybe people are not really leaving these services, but altering what the information is on these services that they're with. Like, say, with Facebook, what I did is I didn't drop Facebook on the May 31st flee from Facebook day. What I did is went through and got rid of all the information that I didn't want possibly leaked out. And really, you shouldn't be putting any information on any site that you don't want public, that you wouldn't want publicly posted on a web page for all to see and all to search under your name. But it is kind of disconcerting that people aren't really penalizing corporations that do leak their information through credit cards or other means. But there's also that side of it where there's almost a monopolistic view on how where this information is, such as Facebook. What is the alternative to Facebook? Are people going to flee to something else? There really is nothing that really rivals what Facebook does for people in terms of connections. I mean, there's a lot of little startups out there that are not even off the ground, or some have gained a little bit and have a bit of backing to them, but nothing that really rivals it. And I think that's the deciding factor. If there was a major competitor or something that offered an equitable kind of alternative to Facebook, then people might be leaving Facebook in droves. But leaving Facebook to go to nothing is not really something that people are looking to do. I mean, just stopping using something, this major thing that has really taken over a lot of the communication streams on the internet. I know some people that don't even use email anymore. All the messages go through Facebook because it's more convenient. They don't even care about their emails anymore. And it's taken over kind of forum pages because there's fan pages and group pages, and mass mailings aren't needed anymore. You just message your group that you set up on Facebook. They've really taken over a lot of the things that used to be in different formats and brought it into under one roof, which is extremely useful. And I can't really see people leaving it unless there's a huge upset. And what people are seeing with this, with Facebook, is that the threat of their information leaking rather than something impacting them directly. And I think it will really take a direct impact of something that Facebook messes up to really wake people up. And that's not really something we want to have happen. So in the meantime, if you're not going to leave Facebook, at least get rid of the information, or try to get rid of the information that you wouldn't want posted up on a telephone pole in your own neighborhood with your picture of your face on it and detailing everything you say on your own Facebook page. It is not private. It is going to all your friends, and those people can post it up as well. And who knows what can let slip in the future on some privacy change that Facebook is going to make up. This message from Coffee Bean. I thought this was pretty hilarious. They said, I also post this in the forums for people to talk about. It was a story Viacom owned on piracy, and a kind of a hypocritic post of what Viacom did in their posting works that other people have made on their own site, making money from it. And, you can take a look at the link. Coffee Bean continues on. Viacom uploaded a video to its video website, Spike.com, of a Creative Commons song written and sung by Jonathan Colton. You'll have to sit through several advertisements before you watch the video, and therefore Viacom are making money off of this, thereby infringing the Creative Commons license, which he has said no commercialism, because he's taken the song is basically taking other Creative Commons pictures off of the internet, putting them up in a video format by flipping between the different pictures, and he's put a song to it describing these pictures. A very clever song. But these pictures are all Creative Commons, attribution, non-commercial, share alike. And he has posted his video, of course, attribution, share alike, non-commercial. What Viacom has done is taken this video and made it commercial. And in the past, of course, Viacom has accused YouTube of making money off of their videos that they say they put a copyright on. They say you can't make money off these videos, and YouTube is putting advertising on videos and people are posting it up. So he continues on. I wonder how much money he will get for this infringement. Will it be in the orders of thousands of dollars? I doubt it. Still, they must pay up. What unfurls regarding all of this will be an interesting proof of concept as to how corporations have the power to do whatever they want. Well, we'll see, I guess. Love the show. Thanks for the time and effort you put into it, dude. Well, you're very welcome. And this is really showing what corporations are all about. They're saying, do as I say and not as I do, because I have a lot of lawyers. And it's really about what they can get away with. It's not a moral standard that they hold themselves to. It's a way of doing business and what they can get away threatening other people with. Because there's been so many lawsuits thrown out by companies to people and then withdrawn after the publicity comes about. It's not a morality thing that they're standing up for. It's what they can get away with and bully people into believing what they can get away with. If you'd like to contact me, ask a question, or to leave a comment, just head over to the Pirate Party radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form. So let's get into the news. And big news, of course, continuing in Canada about Bill C-32 that has recently been tabled for everyone to take a look at. And of course, Michael Geist is heading up a lot of the opposition and information about Bill C-32. And this one is setting the record straight. 32 questions and answers on C-32's digital lock provisions, part 3. So he's posting many different parts to this, and you can download and read the whole PDF. I'm just going to read some of the things. It's extremely informative, and it gives a very good question and answer, point by point, discussion on how C-32 will affect everybody's day-to-day usage, because you read the bill and you're not really sure of how these words are going to affect what you do in your day-to-day operations on the computer and in your everyday life and watching television and consuming media and moving media from one platform to another. It says the first two posts on 32 questions and answers on Bill C-32's digital lock provisions focused first on general issues in the bill, and second on C-32's circumvention exceptions. Today's post discusses the missing exceptions, circumvention exceptions found in other countries, but missing from the Canadian bill. For those who want an all-one single package, I posted the full series as a PDF download, and I do recommend you download that PDF and take a look at all these questions he poses and answers. Now, I'm going to run through some of these, but there's a lot. There's 32 of them, so I'm not going to read all of them out, but really, go and download and read it. Does C-32 include authorized circumventors as in used in New Zealand's to facilitate legal circumventions? No, New Zealand's copyright law introduced a concept of qualified circumventors. The law grants special rights to trusted third parties who are permitted to circumvent on behalf of other users who are entitled to circumvent but technically unable to do so. The current list of qualified circumventors include librarians, archivists, and educational institutes. The approach rightly recognizes that many people will be unable to effectively use the exceptions inserted into the law. By creating a class of trusted circumventors, the law creates at least one mechanism to ensure that users retain the existing copyright rights. So if you're not able to do it, you don't have the technical expertise to be able to archive or access certain media, because you're just not able to do so, there are people that you can go to that are able to do this for you. Are companies required to unlock locked content for legal purposes under C-32? No. Many countries have recognized the danger that combination of DRM and anti-circumvention legislation may effectively eliminate user rights or copyright exceptions in the digital environment. Creating exceptions is one way to address the issue, but another is to adopt an approach of with rights comes responsibilities. In this case, if companies are going to obtain new legal rights for DRM, they must also shoulder the responsibility of unlocking their content when requested to do so by users for legal purposes, because C-32 just locks it down completely with the DRM and does not make exceptions for you to be able to do things like back up things and shift it to different formats on different platforms like your phone or a portable media player or your car for long trips or things like that. Another one, let's skip down here. Does C-32 include a circumvention exception for personal uses? No. While other countries provide a blanket exception for personal use, an established corresponding circumvention exception, Bill C-32, does not. For example, Lithuania's anti-circumvention provisions include a specific exception that preserve the personal use right by requiring content owners to enable legitimate uses. And legitimate uses would be like you've bought a CD, you've bought a DVD, you've bought a Blu-ray, and you want to back it up. Say it's your kid's movie, and you want to back it up because the kids trample on it. They throw it on the floor and step on it and get sticky stuff all over it. And all of a sudden, this is not a useful piece of media anymore. So what you should be able to do in real life situations is back that one up and give the kids the backup copy so they can destroy it. And so you can go back to the original, make as many copies as you want. You have paid the original artists for their work. They're not losing money by you making a copy for your kids to destroy over and over again. This is a winning situation for both the consumer and the producer of the media, but this does not allow for it. What the producers of the media want you to do is go back again and again and again and keep buying the same media over and over, but they've already made their money for it. And the same goes for digital downloads. You're not allowed to make a backup of your digital download on some other form of backup, like a external hard drive that you can keep somewhere else. Say you download thousands of songs from iTunes or some other place. If it's got DRM on it, it's over. And the next one, follows that. Does C32 include a circumvention exception for digital archiving? No. While many countries have expressed concern about the impact of TPMs on the preservation of digital materials, Bill C32 only exacerbates the problem by not creating an exception for digital archiving. Other countries have recognized this danger and sought to address it, etc., etc. And let's see. Does C32 include an exception for circumventing digital locks that become obsolete or broken? We have seen this time and time again, especially in days gone past, of failed digital DRM download stores. I think Walmart, off the top of my head, I believe Microsoft had one as well, where a lot of people signed up to it, paid for these songs, paid for movies, paid for any digital downloads that they have, and now the servers that verify that you have legally bought this DRM-encrusted piece of file that you would like to play now is not playable anymore because it goes to the server and the server says, no, well, there is no server. It can't say, yes, you can play it. So this doesn't give you an exception to be able to keep playing these songs you have paid the money for. All of a sudden, the server switched off and it's gone. It says, no, the inclusion of the right to circumvent in the event that the TPM breaks or becomes obsolete should be relatively uncontroversial. The U.S. Registrar of Copyrights has included a specific exception that addresses this situation since 2000. The exception reflects the recognition that the continual evolution of technology places the investment that the consumers make in entertainment and software products, or that libraries make in materials at risk in the event that a TPM ceases to function or becomes obsolete. And I've been screaming about this for years. I am so hesitant to download anything that checks back with the server, whether it's a video game or a movie or a piece of audio, because all of a sudden my whole library could be shut off in the future. I am a collector of console cartridges, classic console cartridges. I can play video games that were made in the 1970s still, 1980s, but stuff that's made nowadays, 5 years ago, cannot be played anymore because they've switched off the servers or some functionality has been shut down with no alternative because the companies won't release the open source or they won't give you the locks to unlock the program that you've legally purchased and paid for because it just doesn't exist anymore. So it's kind of ironic that older technology is actually more functional than the newer, supposedly better technology out there. Bill C-32's digital lock provisions apply to copyrighted works. Does that mean public domain works are not affected? Affected? No. Concerns about the impact of anti-circumvention legislation on public access and use of public domain materials is frequently addressed by arguing that the legislation only protects works that are subject to copyright. Since public domain materials fall outside the definition, works such as old public domain films that are enclosed with DRM could be lawfully circumvented. So, old stuff that is now public domain, which has to be pretty damn old right now, is not going to be accessible in the future for your children. It's just going to be locked up forever. The servers are shut down. There's no way to unlock it. You're going to be run afoul of the law. And say some great movie, very few copies exist. You're only able to use those copies that exist. You're not able to make copies for fair use because they're in the public domain. Well, you don't even need to put into effect fair use. It's public domain stuff. Anybody can copy it. Anyone can make a copy of it. But if it has DRM on it, it's illegal in Canada if this goes through. Take a read through the whole PDF. There's fascinating questions and answers that puts it into plain English that everyone can understand. It is essential. Even if you don't live in Canada, this kind of draconian measures could be placed in your country because of, as these bills get passed through in the Canadian government, other countries will look to what has been passed in other countries and build on top of that and say, oh, it's already been passed there. We should implement this as well. So it is very important for even countries around the world to look to what is being proposed in Canada, just as Canada looks to the rest of the world as things are passed elsewhere. In copyright news from the U.S., judge may dismiss 4,576 of the 4,577 peer-to-peer defendants from lawsuits sent in by Mind Inversion. Federal Judge Rosemary Collier sits on the D.C. District Court, where several of the recent U.S. copyright group lawsuits against alleged peer-to-peer users have been filed. A few of those lawsuits ended up in Judge Collier's calendar. One of them filed against over 4,000 anonymous John Does at once. This week, Judge Collier issued a terse demand to the lawyers behind these cases. Convince me within 2 weeks that jamming 4,577 people into a single lawsuit is a proper use of court system. A brief entry in the official court docket lays out the order, minute order, requiring plaintiff to show cause in writing no later than June 21st, 2010, why Doe defendants 2 through 2000 should not be dismissed in for misjoinder under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 20, wrote the judge in the steam experiment case. The same order was repeated in a separate case targeting 4,577 users alleged to have shared the film Far Cry. And I must make a correction from last week. Is the director's name of Far Cry is Uwe Boll, not you, as it is a German name. The judge orders came only days after the ACLU and EFF joined forces to file a friend of the court brief in these cases. In that brief, civil rights groups complained about the improper joinder of so many defendants from across the country in a single case in a far-off D.C. courthouse. According to Rule 20, which Judge Collier referenced in her order, plaintiffs may only join defendants in the lawsuit if they assert any right to relief jointly, severally, or in alternative with respect or to arising out of the same transaction, occurrence, or series of transactions or occurrences. Any question of law or fact common to all plaintiffs will arise in the action. But were the alleged distributions all part of the same transaction or occurrence? According to the ACLU and EFF, they were not, as these peer-to-peer lawsuits should be severed and each defendant sued individually. Plaintiff's joinder of more than 4,500 defendants in a single action is improper and runs the tremendous risk of creating unfairness and denying individual justice to the suit, they wrote. Mass joinder of individuals have been disapproved by federal courts in both the RIA cases and elsewhere. The judge appears interested in at least debating the argument. I checked in with EFF staff attorney Corinne McSherry, who worked on the brief, and she was pleased by the order. Of course, we don't know yet how the judge is going to rule, but this order suggests that she is taking the issue seriously, she said. That is a very good thing. Parties in any litigation should be required to follow the rules. But given the number of lawsuits, with more promised, and the thousands of individuals under threat, it's particularly crucial here. Should the judge sever the lawsuits, each would have to be filed separately, with a separate filing fee and separate paperwork, making mass lawsuits much more difficult and expensive. So congratulations. Hopefully the ACLU and EFF had an effect on the judge in this case, and it seems that they have. It's quite coincidental that they would bring this up. And the next story references this as well, of the problems of making this one mass lawsuit for all the people of the U.S. being sued by one place, one person, or one corporation, in fact. Songs of Innocence. Accused peer-to-peer users speak out. This is more copyright news from the U.S. This really shows the actual impact on the people that are being sued. This is statements from people that are named in this lawsuit of 4,500 people. Let's say it right up front. Some large percentage of those targeted in the recent wave of peer-to-peer movie lawsuits are no doubt liable for their piratical behavior. But those who didn't do it face an agonizing choice. Pay $1,500 to $2,500 to settle the lawsuits brought by Dunlap, Grubb, and Weaver. Or pay even more money for a lawyer to plead their innocence. And innocent or not, a case that goes to court always runs the risk of ending in a $150,000 fine. The sheer size of the penalties for online infringement would give anybody pause, as we've heard recently from several of those continually wrestling with what to do. All claim innocent, much like the woman we profiled 2 weeks back, and we cannot evaluate the truth of any particular claim. But if you want to know just who these 14,000 peer-to-peer lawsuits have snared so far, here are a glimpse of how a lawsuit can affect a life. And I'm going to skip through some of these quickly. It's disrupted my work and life for several days, said one father who contacted me after receiving Far Cry settlement letter. I talked to many people about this, and overwhelming reaction was that this is a scam. Just a few said that it will be less of a headache if I pay the $1,500. One said that a good citizen should fight it, not pay. I asked everyone in my family, and everyone said, I did not download it. I do not have little kids who will just get scared, hide in the closet, and deny everything. Such conversations went on for a number of days. We talked about risks and potential cost of a lawsuit. And if there's a slight chance that one of us shared the movie, it would be cheaper to pay the settlement. But he decided not to pay. After all these talks, I cannot just say, you are all liars, I do not trust you, and I will pay the $1,500. I decided that the trust in our family is more important than the money and headache of the lawsuit. I feel I'm doing the right thing. He searched for files named Far Cry on his PC, but found nothing. But an internet connection is tough to lock down completely. Friends come over, relatives stay the night, a neighbor might leech Wi-Fi. So I cannot be 100% sure that there are no BitTorrent traffic from my IP, he concluded. The best I can do is trust what my family says. Nobody ever downloaded this film. Even if the file has ever passed through my router, nobody in my family knowingly gave the command or authorization to do it. And this is the best I can tell. He then raised an unpleasant scenario, the prospect of internet insurance that would pay out if a connection is used for anything illegal. I also realized that since I cannot fully control computers, and if I'm legally responsible for all the traffic through my router, then I should cancel my home internet access. It's just too risky. Or since risk can be addressed by insurance, I can already see internet liability insurance that covers such lawsuits. Now that is a scary prospect of people signing up for internet insurance in case you're sued by some media corporation seeking $150,000 for a song or a movie. But if these people are being dragged to court, I can see it. If you're paying $50 a year for insurance and these companies are sending out at minimum $1,500 pieces of paper, people are going to be looking into that very seriously. There's big business opportunity on all fronts there. Another reader emailed in frustration to say that he had until June 15th to settle for allegedly sharing the film Far Cry, according to the settlement letter he received, but that he still didn't know what to do. Settling would be a huge financial hardship, but hiring a lawyer to help fight the claim would likely cost more. Originally, we got a letter from our ISP stating that they have a subpoena for our name and address. We literally had 2 business days to research and try to find legal counsel on this matter. I called a local ISP lawyer herein. His advice was to contact a lawyer over where this lawsuit originated, Washington, D.C. While we do not have the monetary means or time to try and fight this, I am disabled along with my wife and we live with my parents. My father is also disabled, so there's only 2 incomes coming into our family, and you know the standard of living in blah is bad enough. We lived paycheck to paycheck, so to speak. A tech-savvy reader emailed in outrage over being subpoenaed in the Far Cry case. Here's a quick overview of my situation. I received a subpoena's notice from certain ISP on May 4th with a deadline of May 7th for a response. It included no information as to what the subpoena was, so I immediately tried to contact the sender of the notice. After countless emails and phone calls, I finally reached an informed live person by calling the ISP's corporate line, which I found online and was not included in the notice. I was finally provided a copy of the subpoena itself, and I recognized the date that I was accused of downloading Far Cry, a movie I've never heard of, as a period when I was having internet connection and wireless router issues. I suspected my neighbor may have been using my connection without my permission, and that my ISP should have a record of my support calls. Unfortunately, I tried to hire an attorney that could help me with this, and I was repeatedly told there was little I could do without further information from the ISP. And certainly nothing I could do in the very short period without the subpoena deadline. I did all this in the span of only a few days and still didn't get anywhere. I assume my identity has been sent to the plaintiff, and I can only imagine what others are going through trying to figure out what is going on here. And it continues on and on about personal stories of people having no clue about what Far Cry is. I had never heard of this movie before the lawsuit. And these people have never heard of this movie and have never downloaded this movie. So how are they supposed to defend themselves when it says their IP address, which is logged with the DHCP servers at their ISP, saying that they have downloaded. The person who is signed up to the IS, to the internet connection at their household, and they are liable for it. For the dozens of people that could have been using their internet connection or hacked into their internet connection, what is their recourse? Is there any recourse for the these people that if they take it to court? So a lot of these people are going to be settling for the $1,500 because they just don't have the means to be able to take it to court. And it goes on and talks about people who don't even live anywhere near Washington, D.C., people in Hawaii, people in Alaska, that have to actually travel to the court in Washington, D.C., which is another problem. They shouldn't be sued in one state. They should be pretty much sued in the place that they downloaded the movie from, rather than putting the burden on the person who has been told that they've been downloading this movie. Who's the burden on? It's the burden to prove that they have downloaded it, not accuse them, and then they have to defend their innocence. They are innocent until proven guilty. And they are being dragged into this, kicking and screaming, going, I have never even heard of this movie, Uwe Boll. The next story, copyright news from the U.S. FTC considers iPod, internet, cell phone tax to save newspapers, sent in by Mind Inversion. As if nationalizing the auto industry, banking, and recently healthcare, the feds are now discussing the possibility of nationalizing the news as well. Scared that some of journalism's business models are crumbling, the FTC is floating a draft discussion titled Potential Policy Recommendations to Support the Reinvention of Journalism. Sounds very positive. Which outlines the new possible sources of revenue that the feds can tap into in order to prop them up. First, it tries to deny that it doesn't specifically mean newspapers, the proverbial elephant in the room, but only after first saying that it does. Although many of the issues confronting journalism cuts across different news media platforms, such as broadcast television and radio, most of the discussion in this document will use the perspective of newspapers to exemplify the issues facing journalism as a whole. Studies have shown that newspapers typically provide the largest quantity of original news to consumers over any given period of time, it reads. We include within the term newspapers online news websites run by either existing newspaper or by an online-only news organization. Other sources of news are also important, of course, and proposals for an action should not favor newspapers over other news platforms. If other news platforms are also important, and are likely doing fine, then how can newspapers, however broadly defined, be not unduly favored by the proposal? It seems to me Americans' consumers are making their choices, says Cliff Kincaid, editor of Accuracy in Media, and Washington-based media watchdog group. I don't know why the FTC should interfere with that. The report seems to lament the decline of old liberal newspapers, but they're in decline because consumers are finding their news and information elsewhere. Isn't that really the problem here? Never before in the history of mankind has there been so many sources of news. The real reason why newspapers are dying is that people's news consumption is being diluted amongst a plethora of options. None of this really matters much in the context of what the new potential revenues the FTC thinking that feds can create in order to sustain journalism. Yes, it actually thinks the feds need to tax us more in order to save outdated businesses. It's eerily reminiscent of entertainment cartels like the RIAA and MPAA that want the government to save it as well. So what are the proposed new taxes, you ask? Here they are. 5% tax on consumer electronics. Spectrum auction tax on the auction sales prices for commercial communication spectrum, which means cell phones, etc. 2% tax on advertising dissemination on our broadcast spectrum, which means all advertising, pretty much, I would think. I think that would cover internet and radio and television, just everything. ISP and cell phone tax. The problem with all these new taxes, aside from the fact that there are new taxes, is that it will put the feds in a territory best left to the rigors of independent journalism. If it begins controlling the purse strings of news outlets, then what's to say critics won't be deemed non-crumbling and left to wither on the vine free of its subsidies? And just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, FTC wants Congress to expand the Copyright Act to protect hot news and give news outlets copy protection of short duration and limited scope to the facts reported in the news articles. Wow, that one is the scariest point at all. This makes no sense than taxing cell phones to support the dying rotary phone business, or taxing SMS messages to support telegrams. If your business model is dying, you need to either innovate or move on, not ask for handouts to pay for something that nobody wants and nobody's buying. They're also asking for to copyright facts. They want protectionism for real-world events so that nobody else can report on it. Imagine the only place you could get information about the oil spill was in newspapers for the first 30 days. An effective media ban on television and internet of all mentions of oil spills sounds more like something out of a totalitarian state than some place that I'd like to live in. This makes no sense whatsoever. If people are not reading the old news dissemination places where you can get the news, like newspapers and other places that are failing, and they're reading other newer places like going to online websites, then that's where people are going to. Maybe they should concentrate on that. The old media is dying. The new media is going on. They need to innovate to keep up, not taking money from the places that are succeeding and putting them into the places that aren't succeeding for nobody to read. Why would you give money to places that nobody is reading? Put all that money into the places where people are reading and innovate there and get them going so that people aren't wasting money on propping up something that nobody cares about. Copyright news from the US, RIAA versus LimeWire and some change. Sent in by Mind Inversion, a simple question is presented by a strange move the RIAA has made in the LimeWire case. It just goes to show the math is important, and most of RIAA copyright lawyers don't have the math skills that, say, a patent attorney would. And this question is, did the RIAA just screw itself by asking for statutory damages that appear punitive in excess beyond precedent? Hopefully my math is on. The RIAA requested full damages under Title 17, Chapter 5, Section 504, Subsection C, Subpart 2, which is $150,000 per work. That's $150,000 per song. Even if the court grants the minimum damages per work under the statute, that's $750 per song. The RIAA website has some convoluted statistics, but you see that at a liberal estimate, they do about $15 billion per year. The LimeWire website indicates that there is something like 50 million LimeWire downloads per month. Finding stats on all these numbers have been kind of hard, so I've been reduced to find the plausible maximum minimum scenarios to make my point. 50 million clients per month, but for how long? The reason that accurate stats are hard to come by is that to determine them, one would have to break wiretapping laws and do deep packet inspection on all users of LimeWire since it began. Companies like Tiversa and Guardaule use methods that might not be legal to get information. Guardaule is based in Germany and uses DPI, deep packet inspection, technology to provide evidence of copyright infringement, like for suing thousands of BitTorrent users. But that's another story. Let's talk some numbers. The RIAA said over 200 million copies of LimeWire file sharing software has been downloaded so far, including 340,000 in the last week alone. This is a quote that's been thrown around the internet. So this is a direct clash with the 50 million a month that LimeWire reports to take place. 340,000 in the last week, while there are 4 weeks in a month, and a rate of 340,000 times 4 is about 1.4 million. That's not anywhere close to 50 million. So we have an issue of material fact right there. One side is claiming that another thing that does obviously doesn't agree with the other side. Over 200 million would mean that it's only over a 4 month period. 50 million times a month is 4 months. So let's go with the RIAA's low magic number from wherever, 200 million clients of LimeWire. That will be used as our extremely conservative estimate of the number of times the software has been downloaded. Let's be even more conservative. Let's say that 50% of those people were not new users. We'll say that they have more than one computer, or reformatted or whatever, and they need to re-download LimeWire. So let's say 100 million users only. That number is clearly wrong. It's way too low, but let's go to make a point. This gets very interesting. Stay with me with these numbers. I'm just going to skip down. So if you go with the minimums, it adds up to $75 billion that they're suing for, just millions. And that's very conservative numbers that this article uses. If it goes for maximum numbers, even at 100 million users downloading one song and going at $150,000 at the maximum damage, that is $15 trillion. And that's the GDP of the United States for 1 year. So the RIA is asking for the full GDP, gross domestic product, of the whole United States in 1 year period from LimeWire. Now, something tells me that LimeWire doesn't have this money sitting in a bank account somewhere. I think that would raise a couple of red flags with the IRS, and they'd be asking for a little bit more taxes than probably they're getting from LimeWire. And also, more to the fact that LimeWire doesn't have this money, the people that use LimeWire don't have this money. I'm not understanding where the RIAA is guessing that all this money is lying around that people are not giving to them all of a sudden. $15 trillion where they're asking for. This is outrageous. It's the broken window dilemma where somebody breaks a window and they think that's good for the economy because another window is bought. Well, that's not what happens. If that money wasn't spent on repairing that window, that money goes somewhere else in the economy. It is not magic money that appears from nowhere. It is money that is spent on, say, other forms of entertainment that probably flow back into the RIAA, or spent on food or shelter that they didn't have to begin with to buy your products. So you're not losing any money in that respect. There's not hundreds of millions of people sitting around laughing, sitting back in their chair, listening to your music of the artists that are with the RIAA, with full bank accounts, laughing because, too bad the RIA is not getting my full bank account that I've saved so much money by pirating all these songs. That's not how it works. The money does not exist. The $15 trillion does not exist. And this, even the $75 billion you're not getting does not exist. Because you've only made $15 billion in the last year. So $75 billion, you're thinking you're missing out on five times as much as you make in a year of people not giving money to you? You'll have to give your head a shake on that one. Story concludes. Now, if you're a judge and the RIA approaches you and says, we would like at least $15 trillion in statutory damages as a matter of law, you know that something is just not right with this system. And LimeWire will have a pretty nice case for unconstitutionally excessive damages to take it up all the way and to get them to reverse. And the RIA is not going to want to spend any more money than they have fighting that. Although, with $15 trillion on the line, they might follow it up. Free speech news from the U.S. U.S. military holds soldier in classified video leak, sent by Nephilim. Army Specialist Bradley Manning, 22, of Potomac, Maryland, who was deployed to Baghdad, is being held in pretrial confinement in Kuwait for allegedly releasing classified information, according to a U.S. military statement. The statement did not provide details of the information in question, but in an emailed response to a query, a U.S. official confirmed that the case involved the U.S. military videotape made public in April by WikiLeaks, a group that promotes the leaking of information to fight government and corporate corruption. The gunsight video shows an attack by a U.S. Apache helicopter on a group of men in a square in a Baghdad neighborhood. The group included Reuters photographer Namir Noor Eldin, 22, and his assistant and driver Saeed Chamag, 40. Wired magazine, which initially reported the arrest on its website on Sunday evening, said Manning, an intelligence analyst, came under suspicion after he told a former hacker during an email exchange that he had leaked the video. Wired did not disclose its sources, but quoted from what it said Manning had written. The magazine said Manning also claimed to have leaked other classified information, including a video of a 2009 bombing in Afghanistan that killed dozens of civilians and 260,000 classified U.S. diplomatic cables. Wired reported that WikiLeaks had previously acknowledged it was in possession of the bombing video. It said only one U.S. diplomatic cable had possessed by WikiLeaks. So I'm guessing that's a cable in terms of messages going back and forth. There were no information comments from WikiLeaks, but a person involved with the group said WikiLeaks did not know if Manning used its services because all of its sources are anonymous. Our legal advisors have started working on the case and are verifying how much this military investigation is violating the rights of our sources and us, the person involved with WikiLeaks said in an email. The Pentagon said investigators are taking a very careful look at what classified information might have been divulged by Manning, who was deployed with the 2nd Brigade, 10th Mountain Division. So the important part of this story is how they got the information that the video was leaked by this person, whether it was through legal means that they got this information, that the video was leaked and they didn't do any wiretapping to get this information, which would get the case pretty much thrown out of court. I'm not a lawyer, but if you obtain incriminating evidence through illegal means, I believe that is not admissible in court. So that is why WikiLeaks is investigating whether there were any leaks on their side. So that is a very interesting story that we'll have to keep on top of. Free speech news from Turkey. Turkey bans the use of Google and services. Sent in by Mind Inversion. Turkey has imposed an indefinite ban on internet search engine Google and many of its services, citing legal reasons. In an official statement, Turkey's telecommunications presidency said it has banned access to many of Google IP addresses without assigning clear reasons. The statement did not confirm if the ban is temporary or permanent. Some Google services will be completely inaccessible or take a long time to load, the statement said. Google translation and document sharing sites have also been banned indefinitely, along with YouTube and Facebook in the country. Other services such as App Engine, FeedBurner, Analytics, etc. have also reportedly been banned. So, another strike against another country locking down the free flow of information. And that is a very disturbing trend among many countries, because information is how the world is going to get together. And breaking down these barriers and artificial borders that separate people and ideas, that's how they control the population, is by banning the dissemination of dangerous to the government ideas. And why would the government ban Google? Because it has the capability of getting information that goes against what they're trying to push upon the population. And there's nothing more dangerous than an opinion and an thinking for yourself. And that really is what they're banning, is people thinking for themselves and getting more than one source of information and deciding for themselves. They're not trusting their population to decide what is great, is best for them, or they don't want them to decide what is best for them. They want to dictate what is best for them and keep the people in line. And that is why the internet is so important, and free speech in every country is important, so that people become the power in the country rather than the hands of the elite few. Copyright news from Spain. Good copyright news. Spanish judge likens P2P, peer-to-peer, to ancient practice of lending books. Following an investigation by the authorities, an audiovisual rights collecting society, EGEDA, and Columbia TriStar, in an early 2005, Spanish police embarked on an operation aimed at shutting down popular file-sharing forum CVCDGO.com. Strolls right off the tongue. EGEDA complained that the site allowed members to download movies located on peer-to-peer networks, sometimes which had yet to have a theatrical release. Like many file-sharing sites, CVCDGO had been financed by advertising since its 2004 launch, and in its short life, it allegedly received more than 11 million visits. Conducted by the country's Intellectual Property Crime Squad, Operation CVCD culminated later in 2005 in raids on locations in Malaga, Seville, and Madrid. Their police arrested the four male operators of the site, who at the time were aged between 27 and 37 years old. The servers, meanwhile, remained located in San Diego in the United States. Now, I'm just going to skip down to what the judge said. In the ruling, Judge Acriz, Gutierrez, and Campillo said, since ancient time, there's been the loan or sale of books, movies, music, and more. The difference now is mainly on the medium used. Previously, it was paper or analog media. Now, everything is in digital format, which allows faster, much faster exchange or higher quality of higher quality, and also with a global reach through the internet. Lawyer Carlos Sanchez Amedia, whose law firm defended the case, said that the decision meant that the judges were sending a clear message to the government, informing Culture Minister Gonzalez Sinde that there is a red line that should not be crossed. The judges have taken a stand for freedom on the internet, he added. The decision cannot be appealed. So congratulations to Spain for some common sense. Free speech news from Iran. Artist puts women's dream on screen, sent in by DC. This is another example of the equalizing power of the internet for disseminating information around the globe. It isn't often you hear a director so delighted that their film has been pirated. But Shirin Nishat is overjoyed that her debut feature, Women Without Men, has been doing the rounds of Iran's black market before its U.S. release. I'm grateful to the power of piracy, she says. I'm extremely happy that so many people have seen the film. It is the only way people within Iran can see her film. Even before the exiled director began shooting it, she had no expectation it would be released in her former homeland. She had chosen to base the film on a book of the same title that had already been banned. Nishat has a long history as a visual artist creating work that has explored the hopes and dreams of Islamic women. She first came to attention with her black and white photographic series Women of Allah, which included images of chador-clad women, her face covered in Arabic calligraphy, and her hand carrying a gun. The film, which is screened in competition at the Sydney Film Festival, tells the intersecting story of four vastly different women, an independent spirit who struggles against her tyrannical, fundamentalist brother, her timid girlfriend, an emasculated low-class prostitute of an older society matron, unhappily married to an Iranian general. So that is the power of the internet, exactly. Being able to get information to people who are suppressed by their government. It routes around censorship. You cannot stop the flow of data, no matter what kind of restrictions you place, whether you shut down Google. There's always ways around it. People are extremely creative when it comes to freedom. Patent news from Australia. Pirate Party welcomes legal challenge to breast cancer gene patents. We at the Pirate Party Australia welcome the news that a legal challenge is being mounted over the BRCA1 breast cancer gene, and we hope that the case will be a catalyst for laws to expressly forbid patents on genetic materials. Patents on any genetic material raise large ethical questions, and there are severe implications for the future of scientific research involved in granting monopolies for what are essentially naturally occurring mutations in naturally occurring genes, said Party Secretary Rodney Sierkowski. In recent history, we're seeing a move towards the granting of patents on human genes. Presently, 20% of human genes have been patented and locked away. Genetic patents give private corporations, certain individuals, and research institutes like universities an exclusive monopoly over your genes. Exclusive rights to study, test, or even observe them. This drives the cost of researching and related testing skywards. In the U.S., Myriad Genetics charges women about $3,700 to test for BRCA1 and 2, and the company does not allow second opinions. Wow, that is crazy. 20% of the human genome is held captive by corporations, and you cannot look at your own body unless you pay them a fee or be welcomed into court by their lawyers. Now, this is something to fight against, and I think most of the population of the earth, unless you're a patent lawyer, can understand the importance of this. And this is something that should be highlighted in every Pirate Party platform around the world. And I know that patents are one of the platforms that the Pirate Party stands upon. And it is so obvious that this is important to everyone around the world that they can't even take their own health into their own hands because it's held in the tight grip of corporations, and they can only let you see what your body is doing for a fee. Now, going right into more Pirate Party news, congratulations to the Pirate Party of the Netherlands. The 2010 Dutch general elections garnered the Pirate Party of the Netherlands over 10,000 votes, which unfortunately was not enough to gain the Pirate Party a seat. But congratulations in running in their first elections in the country, I'm sure. This is just the stepping stone to better futures and more people voting for them. And the rally against Bill C-32 for your right to privacy. There's a Pirate Party members are holding in a rally in Calgary, Alberta at the City Hall to raise awareness of the dangers of Bill C-32. So if you live in Calgary or you're planning to travel to Calgary, you can join them on this. I don't have the date. Let me just look that up very quickly here. So if you're in the area at that time, I think it's still in June, but so it is coming up June 27th at 1 p.m. If you're in Calgary at that time, you can join them on highlighting the dangers to the general public and the restrictions that Bill C-32 is going to put upon the Canadians that that sorely need in the future the right to use the data that they pay for or that they need to transport from one item to another and be able to use in a very logical manner and not be holden to the corporations. Balance copyrighted Bill C-32. Pirate Party of Canada is asking for responses to Bill C-32. Tell us what you think balanced copyright means, because that's the word they keep trotting out, is balanced copyright. And the Pirate Party did snatch up balancedcopyright.ca, so people that need to get more information can go to balancedcopyright.ca rather than the government's webpage on balancedcopyright.gc.ca. The most well-written submissions will be posted on the new Balanced Copyright site. So look through all the postings, look through the PDF that Michael Geist has posted with the questions and answers as part of what he has analyzed that Bill C-32 means, and look at the original text as well, and you can interpret it to what you think its impact will be on the Canadian citizens. Now, the free music and media section is sent in by Eric. Here's another TED Talk video link. This one covers the importance of fair use and remixing existing content. It discusses the politics of copyrights and PANS ACTA. This video makes me think that the Pirate Party is in the right place at the right time to ride a mounting wave of popular revolution about the strangling of culture. Well put. This is Lawrence Lessig that you could listen to. He's always good to take a listen to, and his books are excellent. I have a big stack of his books in my house. And here's an older video on the similar subject produced 3 years ago. This talk covers the criminalization of everyday life by overly restrictive copyright laws and calls on content producers to make their content free. Although they have a slightly different perspective than the Pirate Party, these videos are filled with a lot of compelling material. And the next piece of media was sent in my minded version. It's called Patent Absurdity. It's a movie. And the post was mailing out patent absurdity. Patents, as you're probably aware, are government-granted monopolies the last 20 years. They allow the patent holders to restrict others from entering the market. Historically, patents have covered novel machines, processes for industrial manufacture, and pharmaceuticals. In more recent years, patents on software have been granted hundreds of thousands of patents. These patents cover essential techniques in computer programming, and their existence is having a chilling effect on startup companies that I work with. These startups are finding it increasingly difficult to make headway through the software patent thicket. And here's a short summary of the movie that you can download for free legally from the website patentabsurdity.com. Patent Absurdity explores the case of software patents and the history of judicial activism that led to their rise, and the harm being done to software developers and the wider economy. The film is based on a series of interviews conducted during the Supreme Court's review of In Re Bilski, a case that could have profound implications for the patenting of software. So, remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local pirate party around the world, wherever you live, to find out more what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have a news story you'd like to hear in the show, questions or comments, just head over to thepiratepartyradio.com and submit them to me through the form on the website. And thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.